Novelist Carrie Mayer was driving when she heard a story on the radio about the Women of Jane, the 1970s clandestine abortion service in Chicago.
So I just thought, I have to write about these women. As soon as I stopped my car, I fired up Amazon to see if anyone else had written a novel about them, and they hadn't. And I just knew in that moment that I really had to write about them. I was just on fire to do it.
Later in the show, we talk with Mayer about her novel about the Jane Collective, All You Have to Do is Call. But first, we talk with celebrated Malaysian author Tan Tuan Eng about House of Doors, his spellbinding new novel about love and betrayal, colonialism and revolution, storytelling and redemption. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It's 1921 in Penang, a British colony in what was then called Malaya. Famous author Somerset Maugham has come to visit his old army buddy, Robert. As always, he's prospecting for stories to inspire his writing. His host's wife, Leslie, does not disappoint. She confides a story of love and revolution, and another one with a murder mystery at its center, both of which reveal the fault lines of race, gender, sexuality, and power under empire. House of Doors is a beautifully written novel based on real events. An international bestseller, it's long-listed for the Booker Prize. Tan Tuan Eng is also the author of the award-winning novel, The Garden of Evening Mists. Tan Tuan Eng, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure, Francesca. Thank you for having me on your show.
This novel, The House of Doors, first of all, it is some of the most beautiful prose that I have read. The similes, the metaphors, they were absolutely delectable, and I found myself reading certain sentences over again several times just for the sheer pleasure of it.
Well, thank you for saying that, because I worked very hard at coming up with that sort of writing that's poetic and lyrical, but yet at the same time, original. And absolutely spot on, because a lot of times when you have pretty writing, it's not always 100% accurate. And you feel that the writer is trying to shoehorn in the sentence just because it's so beautiful, but it doesn't really work. So I had to be quite ruthless. I had to get rid of a lot of those type of writing as well. While they were very pretty, I felt that they didn't work completely. So they had to go. And as a writer, I think you really have to be quite cold and ruthless about what works and what doesn't.
You have to kill your darlings, as they say.
Yes, that's true.
So this novel is many things, The House of Doors. It's a love story. It's a story about the writer W. Somerset Maugham, a historical novel about Dr. Sun Yat-sen and his movement that ended the Chinese monarchy and created the Chinese Republic. And it's a murder mystery.
It's all of those, yes.
And it was inspired by one of Maugham's stories, The Letter. So it's partly a story about a story and a novel about a novelist. It's just one part of the thread, but I'd love to start out by having you tell us a little bit about the story that Maugham wrote in The Letter and the true story it was based on, about the murder of British colonial William Steward by one Ethel Proudlock.
All right. Well, Maugham wrote his short story called The Letter, which he based it on an actual murder trial, which took place in Kuala Lumpur, Malaya, as it then was, in 1910. I first read the short story when I was in my late teens, and I enjoyed it. I found it very interesting and well-written. But what intrigued me more was when I discovered that he had actually based the short story on this actual murder trial, which had taken place in the city where I was living in and where I had grown up, and which many people seem to know nothing about. So it's always been at the back of my mind to write a novel about the genesis of The Letter and how Somerset Maugham came to hear about it and how he change the facts and transform certain elements and created this short story that really is one of his most successful short stories that he's ever written.
Yes, and also it is part of the story collection, The Casuarina Tree. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, The Casuarina Tree. It's the last story in the collection. There are six stories there, and the letter is the last story in the collection. And that book actually starts The House of Doors, because in the prologue of The House of Doors, the main character, Leslie Hamlin, who is now living in South Africa in 1947 in the Karoo, she receives this particular book one morning. And this book and the story has a lot of ramifications for her. So it sets her off on a train of memories as to what happened when Somerset Maugham came to stay with her and her husband in Penang in 1921.
So bring us to that time and place in Penang in Malaysia in 1921. Also, the story does take place in 1910 as well, and later on, but largely in those two years. Give us a sense of the time and place.
Well, at that time, Malaya was still a British colony, so there was a lot of replication of British society in the colonies, even more so, according to many writers. The English people who were living in these colonies were even more obsessed with appearances and class and differences. Because they were so far away from home, they tried to recreate their idea of what an English society is, far, far away from England. And I think they went to extremes because they became even more obsessed with which school you had gone to, who did you know? Did you know anybody important, the governor or the admiral or a lord or this? So they became very, very conscious of social standing. And it is in this environment which our main character, Leslie Hamlin, functions. She was born in Malaya, so she's always been aware that a lot of people viewed her as less than, what do you call it, pukka, as the British says. So she's always had a chip on her shoulder. And that's one of the reasons why she's so brittle and careful about how she acts and what she says to people.
Hmm. And yet she also violates that too. I mean, she...
Yes.
Yeah.
I think she has to, because you can't function like that's so rigid and repressed in a society which is also trying to constrict you and confine you, especially for if you're intelligent and well-read and you're aware that there's more to life than just the boundaries enclosing you, boundaries created by your own society. So she's very frustrated. She's very angry, but she can't show all of that, of course. She has to play the game and remain cool and unruffled, I would say.
Yeah, and also that theme of people needing to conform to an outward image is more general. It extends to Somerset Maugham himself, as well as her husband. So talk a little bit about this theme of, you know, of a marriage that is based on, not entirely on the truth.
I think that's a sad fact about society then. Somerset Maugham was homosexual. And because the Oscar Wilde trials had just were still very fresh in people's minds, and he had seen what had happened to Oscar Wilde, so he was terrified that the same fate would engulf him. So he was always very careful when he's back in England to maintain the proper facade. In fact, he was married and he had a young daughter as well. But when he was away outside England, and he traveled extensively, he traveled with his so-called secretary, a man called Gerald Haxton, who was actually his lover. And I think a lot of the Englishmen did that sort of thing in those days. You know, they felt that they could cast off the shackles of convention by traveling far, far away from their homeland. And that's what Somerset Maugham tried to do.
So the story does revolve around these two central characters, Leslie Hamlin and Somerset Maugham. Each of them trades off the chapters in terms of point of view. And I'm curious why you chose the first person for Leslie's point of view and the third person for Somerset Maugham's.
Well, originally I wanted to write Somerset Maugham's chapters in the first person as well. In fact, I tried to replicate his voice from what I could detect in all his books, which I had read. But I felt artificial. I felt false doing it. So in the end, I decided that Maugham's chapters would have to be told from the third person. And Leslie's from the first person. Now, Leslie, I wanted her to be narrating the story from her actual own voice because her world's much smaller, much more confined. So she's actually only able to relate what she herself sees or what she personally experiences or hears about. I wanted the reader to feel that sense of confinement. Her world isn't big. It's compared to Somerset Maugham's. Now, he's traveled the world. He's a famous writer, and he's a man as well. So the world at that time was completely open to him. So this contrast between their viewpoints, I felt, also reflected their situation as well as their characters. And I think it worked well to balance out the two different extreme viewpoints.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with novelist Tan Thuan Eng about his latest novel, The House of Doors. Now, Maugham learns while he is visiting, he's visiting Leslie and Robert Hamlin for about 3 weeks in their house in Penang, and he learns while he's there that he's lost all his money due to a bad investment. So he's on the hunt for a good story that can help him recover financially. And that story, in fact, those stories, because really it's more than one, come from Leslie herself. We enter that story with Sun Yat-sen in 1910 and his visit to Penang, which Leslie recounts. What was Sun Yat-sen doing there, and why did you fold this story into your novel?
Well, Sun Yat-sen was actually there for 6 to 8 months. He was fundraising for his revolutionary campaigns. So he was looking for money from what they call the overseas Chinese, the Chinese people who had left the country a generation or two ago and had become quite successful in other parts of the world. So he was trying to gouge money from them to fund his campaign. There are two reasons why I included him in my novel. The first one is that his headquarters on Armenian Street in Penang was actually just a few doors away from the house where my father grew up in the 1950s. So as a kid, my dad was always talking about Sun Yat-sen. Sun Yat-sen used to live on this street just a few doors away. He was very proud of that. I had no idea who Dr. Sun Yat-sen was when I was a child until much later. But when I finally found out who he was and the impact that he had on 20th century history, I was quite amazed, to be honest, that this person actually was on this tiny little street on this island far, far away from China. So that's one of the reasons I decided to, as an homage to my dad, who died in 2013, I thought it would be a sort of a nice testament to him, to include Dr. Sun Yat-sen in the story. The second reason is that he gives a reason for Leslie to feel that she can become part of the wider world, that she can play a part in history because she can see what's happening with the revolution. And Leslie is quite obsessed with being not forgotten by history and by time. But as a woman and as an unremarkable woman, she's a housewife, she's a mother, but she hasn't accomplished anything else. She has this fear that history will forget her. So when Sun Yat-sen shows up, she sees it as an opportunity to play a role in something greater than anything that she could ever imagine. She wants to be remembered by history.
Right. And there's a very interesting part in the book where she's talking with Dr. Sun Yat-sen. He is telling her, and I didn't know this, so maybe you can tell me if this really is true, that he believed in the equality of the sexes, in spite of the fact that he has two wives and possibly even three.
Yes, he had more than he. I think he had three or four. Nobody really knows for sure. You know, that's the interesting thing.
And she calls him on it. You know, yes. Kind of in an uncharacteristic way of calling a guest on something, much yes. less a woman calling a famous man on something.
Yes.
Where did that come from in your book?
Well, you know, first of all, I detest hypocrisy in anyone, especially when that person is involved in politics, or especially, well, let's be blunt, when it's a politician, and most of them are so hypocritical, and I really detest it. So when I had this scene playing out, when I was writing this scene, I thought, all right, here's something to say something against the hypocrisy of politicians. And Leslie as well, she's so angry, she's holding everything in, she's just discovered that, you know, some unpleasant truth about her husband that just that morning when Dr. Sinha said comes to visit later that evening. So she is so filled with anger, she's just trying to lash out at anyone. And here is one man who, even though Dr. Sonia Sen is their guest, here is one man who, in a way, encapsulates her predicament with her marriage. So she's angry that the men have so much freedom, whereas the wives, they just have to suck it up and live with whatever the men tell them to do. And so she's enraged. And I felt that it was justified in her outburst and her calling out this hypocrisy on Dr. Sun's part.
And, you know, it's interesting because, well, in the novel, references made to mom having faced criticism for writing about flawed characters. Is that something that actually happened?
Well, he faced criticisms for writing about real character stories he had picked up a lot on his travels, and he couldn't even be bothered to change their names. Many times he just used their names or, you know, really transparent variations of their names. So he angered a lot of people, and especially so with the letter, when he wrote the letter. And after the letter and the Casuarina Tree was published, he went back to Malaya again for a few months. And he got a very bad reception there from the people there, primarily because, you know, the case of Ethel Proudlock, the people there had wanted to forget her. She's actually the first, one of the earliest cases of what we have today, the cancel culture. They canceled her, they erased her, and they didn't want any reminders of her. And here comes Willie Moore raking up all the mud again. And suddenly Ethel Proudlock is world famous, much to the local people. And Ethel Proudlock will never be forgotten by history because of Somerset Maugham. So it's, I felt it was a wonderful thing he did to write the letter. I just want to shake his hand for doing that.
Yeah, but he does write about flawed characters, and who isn't flawed, frankly, and especially in literature, you don't exactly want to write about one-dimensional characters.
Yes.
But Leslie asks him if he feels godlike, sitting in judgment over the people he puts in his books. And he answers, I am the last person in the world to judge anyone. So why does he say that?
Well, if you read his novels, he never judges people's weaknesses. The only thing he was very much against was also hypocrisy. His stories actually deal with the hypocrisy of the British in these outposts. You know, here the British are trying to impose order and morality on the local people by telling them that us whites, us British, are so much superior to you because we are morally superior. But in the meantime, they are just as flawed as anyone else. So he hated that, I sense, in all his writings. He wasn't really writing about adultery or murder or all these unsavory affairs, even though he was making a lot of money from those stories. But he was actually writing about the hypocrisy of how the British dealt with these things. So that's one of the reasons I think I wanted to bring that in as well, you know, and for him to say that as well, that he doesn't judge anyone. He's the last person, and he knows it. Now, here he is, he's unfaithful to his wife, he's a bad father, he's enthralled to his really unpleasant lover. Who is he to judge anyone? And he accepts that.
We're talking with Tan Thuan Eng about his new novel, The House of Doors. So hypocrisy, you mentioned it before, is something that you hate. I mean, do you feel a connection to mom before writing this book, let's say? Or did you deepen your connection to him through it?
Well, I think the connection was slight to begin with. It was just basically the short stories he wrote, especially those he set in the Far East and Malaya. There was a sense of familiarity when I read those stories. And because I'm writing about those times as well, a lot of critics have said, oh, he's doing a Somerset Maugham with his novels, which really isn't 100% accurate. But the more I research him, the more I read his especially his journals and his nonfiction and his essays, I find him a fascinating character. I see a lot of his frustrations as a writer in my own frustrations as well. And I think a lot of writers share the same frustrations as well. So there's a, yes, I do feel a connection with him as a writer, but not as a personality, because he's such a famous and successful writer. So there's no way I can match that.
Well, you're doing pretty good. I mean, this has been longlisted for the Booker Prize. Your previous novel was shortlisted. The first one was also longlisted. So, you know, you're doing pretty good.
Yeah. But that's an anecdote I'd like to share. A few weeks ago, I received an email from a woman. And she said that her name is Siri, and she's Somerset Maugham's great-granddaughter. She was writing the email on behalf of her mother as well, Camilla, who was Somerset Maugham's granddaughter. And they thanked me for, A, writing about Somerset Maugham and making him, as they said, relevant to modern-day readers again, but also for reminding them of what their memories of Somerset Maugham were, of how what a doting grandfather he was, despite his public image as surly and grumpy and unfriendly. They said that he was actually a very good grandfather, very doting, very loving. And yeah, it was a lovely email to receive. And I felt quite teary-eyed when I finished reading it. Very moving, the email.
Absolutely. I mean, just the sense that you could change something about the way the person that you're writing about is being perceived. I mean, you've inspired me. I'm going to go read the letter at the very least, if not the Casuarina Tree.
But you must read the letter, please, after you've read The House of Doors, because I've positioned The House of Doors as a sort of mirror to the letter. So once you've read The House of Doors, it changes how you read the letter. And that change in how you read the letter would reflect back on how you perceive The House of Doors. So the slightest tilt in the angle would change, you know, your perception of any of those two works. And it keeps going back and forth. And that's the effect I was trying to create when I wrote The House of Doors, that in the end, the writer doesn't know which came first, you know, which one came first, basically.
Oh, that's so interesting. Could you say just a little bit more about that?
Well, in many ways, The House of Doors is a reverse engineering of the letter, in that I tried to imagine how Somerset Maugham came to write the letter. So after you finish The House of Doors, you think that you know, oh, this is how he wrote the letter. And when you read the letter, you see elements in there which weren't in The House of Doors. And you're wondering, okay, did Leslie leave out something, or did Maugham leave out something which Leslie had told him for reasons we can't tell? And why did he use Leslie's name as the main character in the letter? Why did he not use Ethel's name? Little things like that. It sort of bounces back and forth, like a little ball, back and forth, changing little your perceptions, your understanding of both works.
That must have been great fun.
It was. It really was. You're the first interviewer to say that. But it was, gosh, I really enjoyed the games I was playing between myself, and then trying to imagine the effect on the reader as well.
So finally, I wanted to ask you something about, well, I guess the colonial aspect or the colonial voice in this book. You were born in Malaysia?
Malaysia, yes. Yes, I was born in Penang, actually. So I grew up there until about 6 or 7 years old, and then my family moved to Kuala Lumpur. because my father worked in a bank and he got transferred around the country a lot. So we were always on the move every 2 years, 2 or 3 years.
But in this book, in The House of Doors, Tan Tuaneng, you write from the point of view of the colonial power. Chinese yes. men are called Chinamen.
Yes.
You know, the woman accused of murder, Ethel Proudlock, is more excoriated by her peers for having been helped by the Malaysian authorities yes. than even killing the person that yes. she kills. So I wonder if you could talk about what it feels like to write from the point of view of the interloper, the oppressor, the racist.
It's not an agenda that I set out to have, because all my books and all my writings, I don't wish to have an overt agenda. I don't wish to have lessons for to cram down the reader's throat. You know, it really comes down to the story and what the story requires, what works best for the story I have in mind. So there wasn't really an intention to, okay, I must write from so-and-so's point of view because it's the done thing. But I'm really looking more from the dramatic effect of who is in the best position to tell this story. And with the words like Chinaman, those words were actually used in those times. Those words were thrown about in 1910, 1920s, even up to 1930s and 40s. And I wanted to use those words because I wanted the reader to feel uncomfortable. Today, the readers today, as I mentioned, I said to somebody a few weeks ago, I'm glad you feel uncomfortable, because if you did not feel uncomfortable reading those words, then I despair of you. So, yes, I'm glad you feel uncomfortable. And Somerset Maugham used those words as well in his own stories. So I wanted those words in as well to show how far we've traveled, you know, from today and from then. Because if we don't remember the weight, the loaded words that were used, then we'll forget history's lessons. We'll think that the past was very happy and everybody was equal and everybody was treated well, but it wasn't like that. And we must always, always remember that. And one of the ways to remember is to actually, in a way, experience the way to time travel back to the past. And then to feel uncomfortable and awkward. And that's the effect as well. That I think it makes us more sensitive and better persons to have read those words and to know that it was wrong. It makes us better human beings as well.
Yeah, well, it definitely made me feel uncomfortable.
Yes, good. God, I'm glad.
I mean, in fact, I was shocked at first. And then it was like, oh, no, of course, this is historically accurate. Yes.
And you have to be authentic when you're writing historical fiction. You can't impose today's values on a tale that happened 100 years ago, because the reader can sense it. The moment you have this modern day agenda imposed on the story which you said 100 years ago, it's not going to feel real. It's not going to feel authentic. It's going to feel like another civic lesson that somebody is trying to force feed you. And somebody many years ago told me, persuasion is better than force, you know, if you want to change somebody. So storytelling is by way of persuasion rather than forcing somebody to change.
Well, it was a delightful way of being persuaded. This is just such a wonderful novel, The House of Doors. And this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Francesca. I really enjoyed the chat.
Tan Tuaneng. Read an excerpt from House of Doors by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, a novel about the famed clandestine abortion service, Jane. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In this post-Roe time, when the Supreme Court has stripped women of the constitutional right to decide when or if they will bear children, it's vital to remember what it was like before Roe. It's also vital to remember how some incredibly courageous women and their male allies, like those of the clandestine abortion service Jane in Chicago, how they organized to provide reproductive choice to women in spite of the ban on abortion. Carrie Mayer brings that history to life in her engaging new novel, All You Have to Do Is Call. While her characters are fictional, the novel illustrates the true history of Jane, its foundation in the women's liberation movement, race and class disparities in that movement, and the risks facing the brave women who participated. A previous guest on Writer's Voice, Dolan Perkins Valdez, who we interviewed about her book, Take My Hand, said of All You Have to Do Is Call, quote, a captivating tale of women sacrificing everything in order to support other women. Everyone should read and discuss this book. Everyone. In addition to All You Have to Do Is Call, Carrie Mayer is the author of three previous novels. Carrie Mayer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This was just a terrific read, All You Have to Do Is Call. It's a novel that's based on the real clandestine abortion service in Chicago. It's called Jane. In 2022, we spoke with one of Jane's founders, Laura Kaplan, about her nonfiction book, The Story of Jane. But refresh our listeners' memory. What was Jane, and how did you decide to write a novel about it?
Yeah, well, I read Laura's book and it was terrific. So the story of Jane came to me via an NPR news story in the, I like to call it the before times of 2018. I was driving to meet my friend for a movie and I was listening to NPR and they did one of their kind of wonderful extended news stories. And it was about the women of the Jane Collective. And, you know, I was just listening to this, getting more and more amazed at the real life story of Jane as I listened. I mean, here were these very young women in Chicago in the late 60s who were part of the women's lib consciousness raising groups, protesting for equality, who were making phone calls on behalf of their friends to procure safe abortions from providers in the city of Chicago. And slowly but surely, actually not that slowly, pretty rapidly, they grew into a huge organization. It was started as a referral service, and then it became, they took over the process ultimately to deliver the abortions themselves. So it was an entirely women-run reproductive healthcare clinic. They did more than just abortions. They did birth control counseling and, you know, STD testing and pap smears and things like that also. They were like a proto-Planned Parenthood. So I just thought, I have to write about these women. As soon as I stopped my car, I fired up Amazon to see if anyone else had written a novel about them, and they hadn't. And I just knew in that moment that I really had to write about them. I was just on fire to do it.
You just mentioned the before times of the before the pandemic. It was also before the reversal of Roe versus Wade, the Dobbs decision. Had you finished the novel by the time Dobbs got reversed? I mean, Roe?
No, I was revising it. And when I talk about the before times, I mean, I think both the pandemic and Dobbs and the sort of the social and legal slow march to Dobbs, I was one of those people who was surprised by the decision, but also thought, well, of course, because this is where we've been heading for the last many decades, unfortunately. So I wasn't altogether surprised. There was a kind of horrible inevitability to it. But, you know, both things, you know, and the Trump presidency showed me a lot of things that went into this book. You know, the pandemic in particular really showed me the incredible call to service of medical professionals, you know, nurses and doctors alike, who were really willing to put everything, including their own lives and safety, on the line to help other people. And even though there's no pandemic in my novel and nobody is sick in that way, I really took that to heart. And the women of Jane were not, crucially, they were not doctors and nurses. They were women like me with no special medical training, but they learned to give this one procedure and they learned to do it safely and with dignity. And that really made an impression on me. And as the pandemic was unfolding, you know, seeing doctors and nurses treating their patients with also, you know, with safety and dignity also made an impression on me. So in that sense, that the pandemic is a little bit in the book.
And then what were your thoughts when Da passed? I mean, you were revising. Did you change anything?
You know, it's such a good question. And no, I didn't change anything. I did lean in a little bit harder to some of the legal aspects that were already present in the novel. So the novel takes place mostly in 1971 and 72. And this was a time of great optimism in the women's movement. There were two laws that were kind of on the table at this time. There was the Comprehensive Child Care Development Act, which would have offered universal childcare and preschool to all families, right? Which would have made an incredible difference in the lives of women who wanted to work, right? And dual income working families, which passed both the House and the Senate, but was vetoed by Richard Nixon. Also, at this moment in our history was the Equal Rights Amendment, which is sometimes called the ERA, which all it had to do was be ratified by the correct number of states, I think it was 36, in order for it to become law and make equality under the law for people of all genders, right? Also, it sort of is a complex history to that, and it went past 1972. But in this moment that I'm writing about, there's a lot of hope and letter writing and protesting and lobbying to get that Equal Rights Amendment passed. It still languishes away unpassed. It is not yet an amendment to the Constitution. So I leaned a little bit into those themes and facts in the novel because I really wanted modern readers to know what the legal stakes were at this time beyond just Roe. So I think that's the way in which Dobbs kind of changed it for me.
Yeah, it was very striking to me, as a matter of fact, because we are entering a childcare crisis because the childcare provisions of the pandemic have sunsetted. And thanks to, or no thanks, to the Congress, to particularly the Republicans in Congress who voted to a man against it, including Mitt Romney, who's, you know, being celebrated right now as being the non-Trump, they all voted against reauthorizing that child care. The Equal Rights Amendment, as you point out, is still not there. And we are, in fact, worse off. I mean, I think what's happening around abortion now is even more restrictive. And they're talking about restricting even contraception, which maybe wasn't as easy to get back then, but it was a lot easier than if they outlaw it at the Supreme Court, as Clarence Thomas would like.
Yes. Yes. I mean, people can't see me. I'm nodding my head vigorously as you are talking. We have gone backward in a lot of ways, you know, but I think it's also important, otherwise we would give up. It is also really important to look at the ways in which we have come a long way since the 1970s, right? You know, feminism and reproductive justice are far more inclusive conversations than they ever were. You know, now the National Organization for Women has changed their mission statement to center the lives of women of color within the United States and all over the world. And so there's a lot more textured conversation around what it means for a woman or a person to have bodily autonomy.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you write in your, which I found very interesting, your author's note at the end, you said that you included issues of reproductive justice from a Black perspective, and you were inspired by Dolan Perkins Valdez, who we've also interviewed, a wonderful book that she wrote. And I believe it was a novel, yeah, that was a novel that she wrote about the case of
The Relf sisters. It was another, so it was Take My Hand. It was one of my favorite novels of last year. And like a little bit like All You Have to Do Is Call, she took the real life story of the Relf sisters and wrote a novel about two sisters in Alabama in 1973 and the nurse who helped them. And, you know, I was really struck by so many things about the novel. And of course, you know, I knew that Roe didn't fix everything. It was far from it, right? But to really see how even after Roe, just terrible crimes were being committed, you know, on women's bodies, especially women of color in the United States, it was really an eye-opening book.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, in fact, I want to get back to that to talk about one of your characters, Phyllis. But before we do that, this wonderful novel, All You Have to Do Is Call, Carrie Mayer, well, you actually write, again, in the author's note, that the ethos of this novel is that women's sovereignty over their own bodies is synonymous with liberation and a cornerstone of the National Feminist Project. You say it's rooted in historical reality, and you also say it's something that has gotten lost in some senses since that time. So say more about that.
Yeah, you know, this was probably one of the most eye-opening aspects of the research that I did, which is that not just feminists, but everyone in the late 60s and early 70s talked about abortion totally differently than we talk about it now. I was born in 1975. Okay. So, I was 13-ish by the time I became aware of this stuff at a time when, boy, the self-styled, I'm going to put this in rabbit ears, pro-life movement was in full swing. And so the whole language around abortion was really taken over by that pro-life movement, which we now tend to call the anti-abortion movement appropriately, because when people talked about abortion in the 70s, it was in terms of liberation. It was in terms of bodily autonomy and sovereignty and healthcare. It was not talked about in terms of life in the same way that it's talked about now. And I think that a lot was lost, you know, when the connection between women's liberation and bodily autonomy and reproductive justice, when that connection was severed, a lot was lost. And I do think what I'm seeing now, especially post-Dobbs, is a kind of reclaiming of the language around reproductive justice and abortion as healthcare. I see that everywhere now. Abortion is healthcare. And we haven't gone back to the language of the 70s because that does seem antiquated to us now, appropriately. But it's definitely, you know, the modern women's movement and people who are fighting for reproductive justice are taking the language out of the context of the pro-life movement. And I think it's making, I hope and believe that it will make a big difference.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Carrie Mayer about her novel about the abortion collective Jane in Chicago in the early 1970s. All You Have to Do Is Call. So let's talk a bit about some of the characters. As you said before, when you spoke about Dolan Perkins Valdez's novel, she based her characters on the Ralph sisters, but she gave them fictional characters. You go even further. You do not base your protagonist, Veronica, who is a founder of Jane, on Heather Booth, who is still living, the actual founder. Talk about the choices you made in terms of your characters and their relationship to historical people.
You know, thanks for asking this question. There's a couple of ways and things that I want to talk about here. One is, you know, if people have followed me from my first three novels, which were biographical novels about real women like Kit Kennedy and Grace Kelly and Sylvia Beach, this is a real departure from that, you know. So even though there were real women like Heather Booth and Judith Arcana and Laura Kaplan, who you mentioned earlier, who were members of Jane, my characters are not at all based on them. They are entirely fictional. And there were several reasons for that. One was I had written these three biographical novels and I wanted a new challenge. You know, I wanted to create characters from whole cloth and see where that took me. I also my gut was telling me at the very beginning that I really wanted to be able to tell this story without being beholden to any one person's real life. I really wanted to be able to just go to the places that my imagination wanted to go. So, you know, those are some important reasons why I decided to invent the characters. You know, the other thing that's more factually based is that the Women of Jane, you know, Heather Booth was only in college when she started Jane as a referral service. And I really wanted my characters to be older than that. I wanted my characters to have children already. Two of my three narrator characters have children. And Veronica, who you mentioned, is my founder character. She's pregnant with a second child during the course of the novel, which was really important to me. I wanted her already to have one and be pregnant with another one during the course of the novel for all kinds of thematic and narrative reasons. So I couldn't base her on the real Women of Jane in that sense. So those are some of the reasons, you know, why I made those decisions.
And in fact, one of the points that you make, I think, that is really exemplified by Veronica and even the other women who have children in the book in All You Have to Do Is Call. And that is, and I'll quote you here, you say, "There's an underlying idea in our culture and in the debates about abortion that have unfolded in the last 50 years, that the people who get and give abortions are, quote, other, unquote, because abortion is antithetical to family life and motherhood itself. The anti-abortion movement that emerged following Roe has carefully and successfully grown this chasm in our minds, even in the minds of pro-abortion liberals, by cultivating the notion that abortion is something to be kept secret and a mark of shame." So talk more of that. And do you also see that that has changed since the Dobbs decision?
You know, I said this much better in the book than I said it 5 minutes ago when I was fumbling around in one of my answers to your questions. So yes, I mean, I think this is what I was trying to get at about the way in which the, quote, pro-life movement hijacked the language around abortion, right? It was a successful campaign to get people on both sides of this issue to think about abortion as a mark of shame, a scarlet letter, we might say, on the life of the woman who received the abortion and even those who provided them, right? I don't think that this idea was necessarily adopted by all the providers or all the women who received abortion. I mean, people in the last 50 years have received wonderful abortion care that they have not reflected on as the worst day of their lives. But the national conversation around this topic has had that flavor. And I do think it's changing. I don't, as I said earlier, I don't think it's going back to the kind of women's lib language of the 70s. But the more I read about it now, even women's march language and, you know, rallies and things that I've gone to, when I see it in the news, it's discussed more matter-of-factly. People don't whisper the word abortion anymore. We just say it. And it is discussed as a matter of healthcare and reproductive rights and equal rights for people who can carry children.
Also, even the word feminism, I mean, there was a whole backlash against feminism. And many women said, oh, I'm not a feminist, as if that's something to be proud of. You point out that, well, this movement in the 1970s, and actually I was part of it. I was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison right at this time, 1970, 71, 72. And in fact, I remember I will confess that I had an abortion just right after Roe versus Wade, right after it became legal. So I remember that time. And, you know, history has called that the second wave of feminism. And you talk about the third wave of feminism, which is connected to this idea of reproductive justice. So tell us now about your character, Phyllis, because I wanted to come back to this point. You know, Black women in many ways really advancing the thinking about reproductive freedom and reproductive rights.
Yes. Well, before I answer that question, I just want to thank you for your honesty on this subject. I think that the more we normalize abortion, the easier it will become for everyone to talk about. So Phyllis, she was a tough character for me to write. You know, the real life Jane Collective had very few Black members at the same time that they were serving a largely Black population in Chicago, especially after 1970, when New York State legalized abortion, women of means, which tended to mean white women, would take themselves from Chicago to New York City or somewhere in New York to get a legal abortion, and then they would come back home. But, you know, Jane really decided, as a collective, decided to stay. They thought about closing down at that moment and maybe becoming a referral or even like a shuttle service to New York. But they decided that the need in Chicago was too great. And in fact, it really was. Like, you know, the estimates, they couldn't keep records because of the clandestine nature of their service. But the estimates are that they provided some 10 to 11,000 abortions in Chicago. So Phyllis represents, you know, the very small number of women who were involved with Jane, Black women who were involved with Jane. And, you know, I tried to give her, you know, a voice that was authentic for the time. For a woman who is in her position, she becomes a friend of Margaret's. She's a colleague of Margaret's at the University of Chicago. You know, she's on her way to becoming an academic, and she gets involved with this organization. And I don't want to plant too many spoilers here about Phyllis, but you know, she also has she's in a long-term relationship with an educator named Keith. And they have a really important story. She has a personal story, a personal stake in the fight for reproductive justice. And it was really like a privilege and fascinating to explore her story.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Carrie Mayer about her novel about the famed clandestine abortion service Jane, All You Have to Do Is Call. Yeah, and also, you know, it struck me that with maybe two exceptions, the men in this novel are pretty sympathetic to the cause. How did you make that decision? Because it could have gone a different way. There were not necessarily all that many men who supported it, but the men in this book largely do.
Yeah, the men in this story are largely involved with the important women characters, right? So we have Keith, who's the educator, who's in a long-term relationship with Phyllis. And then we have Veronica, the founder's husband, Doug, who's also a lawyer. And we have her best friend, Patty's husband, Matt, who's a doctor. And, you know, this took a lot of drafts to accomplish. It was important for me to show several relationships in the book with men who were supportive, and it would resonate with 21st century readers as a supportive marital relationship while not being anachronistic. So I didn't have, you know, 21st century therapy speak at my disposal to talk about their relationship. So they needed to be men of their times, just as the women characters are women of their times. But again, I wanted to explore meaningful, fulfilling, long-term marriages in the book alongside the women's quest for reproductive autonomy. And of course, that's going to cause some friction in some relationships. So I wanted to explore what that friction might look like as well.
You know, I think most of the characters were very sympathetic. One of the things that made this book such a pleasure to read was that I felt that these were real people who were struggling with real issues with the best of intentions, even when they were against abortion, except for one of the exceptions again. Well, he may have had good intentions as well. But, you know, you mentioned Patty. This is a woman who's married. She's got kids. She's Veronica's best friend. But she traverses a path from, you know, one position to another position. And it was just delightful to be able to see her go through this. And above all, it was the personal connection that made a difference to her. Is there anything you'd like to say about that?
Well, you know, I think that this idea of the personal connection is so important. You know, Patty's personal connection to this issue didn't actually really emerge until a much later draft. I was trying to get her to traverse this divide, like you were articulating, in other ways. And it was tough, like it wasn't quite working. And I did need to give her the personal connection. And, you know, we see this all the time, I think, in the popular culture, you know, like the Cheney family, who was had very different opinions about LGBTQ plus rights until, you know, one of the members of their family came out as gay. And I think that it very often isn't until we are confronted with something on a deeply personal level that we have to really examine our view of it. And so, hence Patty.
Yes, and a wonderful character. No, I did mention the exception. You do go into this novel, Carrie Mayer, into All You Have to Do Is Call, into the both the protection of Jane by, surprisingly enough, important people in the police department as well as in the clergy, but also the ultimate persecution of Jane, which was, you know, no spoilers here. You know, the women of Jane, there were arrests and they were saved by the bell of Roe versus Wade. So they faced serious jail time. Talk about this part of the history, which some of it was quite new to me.
Yeah, you know, it was new to me too. So I was also, I might focus a little bit on the clergy referral service here. I mean, I think everything you just outlined in terms of the timeline is accurate, right? So, and whenever we write historical fiction, I think I and my colleagues, we know that a lot of readers are just going to Google what happens. So, especially when we're writing about a real thing like the Jane Collective. And so I think part of what we're doing really is trying to make the journey to the destination we all know about as interesting as possible, right? So so many readers are going to know that members of Jane were arrested in 1972. That's not a mystery that drives the book. It's what happens to these people on the way to the arrest and in the wake of the arrest, right? And I think one of the things that is interesting about this journey is this clergy referral service, which is not a focus of the book, but it is an important thing that I wanted to really show, which is historically accurate. It wasn't a formal organization, to the best of my knowledge, of clergy, but it was across beliefs, right? So we had Catholics and Protestants and Jewish rabbis who, in their cities and in their communities, figured out who the safe providers were. And when a member of their community came to them and told them that they needed help, these clergymen got those women to the providers that they needed to see. And in the wake of Dobbs, when there were so many news stories about what had happened, but also what were we going to do now? I remember hearing at least one news story about the reconvening of the clergy referral service. And the clergy referral service wasn't just in Chicago. It was everywhere, right? It was clergymen in churches and temples all over the United States who were helping women get the care that they needed quietly. So I really wanted to show that that was part of the history of this.
And even not just the clergy referral service, but there were people high up in the Chicago Police Department, not exactly a progressive organization, who also did referrals to Jane.
Yes.
Well, Carrie Mayer, this is, this is a terrific read. I thought the characters were so compelling. The dialogue was just absolutely wonderful. I mean, just from the point of view of the sheer writing of it, it was a joy to read, and about such an important subject. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Oh, Francesca, thank you for having me. It was really an honor.
Carrie Mayer, read an excerpt from All You Have to Do Is Call, by, you guessed it, going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. And you can read interview transcripts at the Writer's Voice Substack. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.